a Me Too reckoning today on the world. I'm Marco Werman. Harvey Weinstein is arrested in New York on rape charges, and for some of his alleged victims, it's an encouraging moment.
Hopefully it will be an amazing day for his survivors to know that there is some, albeit slow, justice. There will be justice. It's just the beginning of that process.
Also, a new law in Sweden aims to support rape victims by clarifying what constitutes consent.
We must go beyond the slogan, a no is a no, and turn it into everything before a yes is a no.
Plus, a crackdown on advocates of women's rights in Saudi Arabia sends a chilling signal.
It's really a massive warning sign to anyone else in the country who dares open their mouths.
Those stories today here on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World on a Friday. Thanks for being with us. 7 months, that's all it's been. It's easy to forget that the investigation into movie mogul Harvey Weinstein, which launched the global Me Too movement, only began in October. Today, that movement got a significant boost. Weinstein turned himself in this morning to face charges of sexual assault. As Weinstein arrived at the police station in Lower Manhattan, reporters shouted questions at him.
Harvey, what took you so long?
Jamie Deerwester is an editor with USA Today. I asked her to walk us through the charges against Weinstein.
There are two major charges, rape in the first degree, which is against an unnamed victim from 2013. And then there is the criminal sexual act, which pertains to one of the named accusers. Her name is Lucia Evans, and she maintains that in 2013, she went to Miramax's offices to meet with Harvey Weinstein, and she was led into a private room with him and forced to perform oral sex on him.
So in addition to the criminal charges, there are also several ongoing civil cases against Weinstein. Isn't that right?
I believe there are about a half dozen, and a couple of them are trying to get class action status, as I recall. There's one suit by a former assistant who worked for him in New York who said that she was forced to basically arrange his conquests and then clean up afterwards and get his Viagra and penile injection medicines, which is really not in the scope of a normal assistant job description. I believe there have been cases by aspiring actresses who went to an interview with him going back as far as like the early 80s.
What comes next for Weinstein? Do we have a general timeline for what's going to happen next?
So after he was booked today, he was taken to Manhattan Criminal Court and arraigned on $1 million cash bond. Weinstein surrendered his passport. He waived his right to extradition, which means giving up the right to a hearing if he happens to be in any other jurisdiction and is called back to New York. And there is a civil protection order against one of the accusers, which is presumably the unnamed rape victim. He has a hearing on July 30th, and this may not be the end of it because the grand jury is still going on. He has until May 30th to advise the grand jury whether or not he's going to testify. His lawyer, Benjamin Braffman, who's already said that Weinstein had entered a not guilty plea and he would fight to get the charges dismissed. And we should also forget that he is under investigation in Los Angeles, Beverly Hills, and London. So it's far from over.
Yeah. So it's actually been a very little time since the Weinstein investigation started. That was just last October. Do you remember that day, and how has the scope of the Me Too movement expanded?
I do. I remember it all too well, in fact. It was October 5th, and that was when the New York Times story broke. And then within a week, the New Yorker published Ronan Farrow's interviews. Basically, I think within a couple weeks of the two stories breaking, Weinstein decamped to Arizona for rehab treatment. And not too long after he got to Arizona, he was out to dinner and a fellow diner came up and slapped him. So I would say that the industries most affected after Hollywood are our industry, the media, especially television, and to a probably a lesser degree, the tech industry. There's been some crossover in the case of Amazon, where their studio head was forced out because a producer alleged that the chief of Amazon Studios made a pass at her. Weinstein's basically become the father of the Me Too movement, albeit unwittingly.
Jamie Deerwester there. She's been covering the Weinstein case for USA Today. More reaction now to today's news. First from Weinstein's lawyer, Benjamin Braffman. Outside the courtroom, Braffman said Weinstein plans to fight the charges.
We intend to move very quickly to dismiss these charges. We believe that they are constitutionally flawed. We believe that they are not factually supported by the evidence. And we believe that at the end of the process, Mr. Weinstein will be exonerated.
Meanwhile, prosecutors say their investigation is ongoing, and they're encouraging survivors to come forward to testify against Weinstein. Some of the women who have already spoken out against him have been speaking about today's news. Actress Rose McGowan was one of the first to accuse Weinstein. She said he sexually assaulted her in a hotel room during a film festival. Today, McGowan said she was encouraged.
Hopefully, it will be an amazing day for his survivors to know that there is some, albeit slow, justice. There will be justice. It's just the beginning of that process. And if we can see this through to the end, I hope we emerge victorious. And if anything, we have emerged victorious, no matter what.
Italian actress Asia Argento has also accused Weinstein of sexual assault in her case during the Cannes Film Festival in France, an incident that allegedly happened years ago. But Argento recently used this year's Cannes Festival to again make her point.
I have a few words to say. In 1997, I was raped by Harvey Weinstein here at Cannes. I was 21 years old. This festival was his hunting ground. I want to make a prediction. Harvey Weinstein will never be welcomed here ever again. He will live in disgrace, shunned by a film community that once embraced him and covered up for his crimes. And even tonight, sitting among you, there are those who still have to be held accountable for their conduct against women, for a behavior that does not belong in this industry, does not belong in any industry or workplace. You know who you are, but most importantly, we know who you are, and we're not going to allow you to get away with it any longer.
Despite that applause, Argento later said she did not feel that much support in the room as she made those comments at Cannes. The only overt support she said she got was a hug from director Ava DuVernay and some kind words from Spike Lee. Speaking of support, let's take a look at a law that is intended to support victims of rape. It's a new law that's recently been passed in Sweden and goes into effect July 1st. It states that participation in sex has to be grounded on free will or consent. One immediate effect is that the burden of proof for sex crimes in Sweden will no longer be whether a perpetrator used force, threats, or took advantage of someone in a vulnerable situation in order to get a rape or sexual assault conviction. But defining consent can be tricky. The new law states that participants need to agree in words or actions that they want to engage in sexual activity, and the law creates a new crime, negligent rape. Sarah Backstrom is a senior legal advisor for the Swedish Association for Sexuality Education in Stockholm. We asked her to explain what might constitute negligent rape.
So if someone has been raped and the prosecutor could not prove that there was intent, the court can still make this assessment, like if someone should have understood that something was wrong and there was something that person could have done in that situation, like asking or seeing if the person was awake, etc. The court then could decide that the person is guilty of criminal negligence rape.
Can you give me an example?
If someone rapes someone that is badly intoxicated, for example, and says, well, I didn't realize that he or she was badly intoxicated, then the court could see, okay, so what was the height of the alcohol level in the blood? So this person was really, really badly intoxicated. And the person claims, I didn't understand that. So then the court can see, okay, but this person was badly intoxicated. If you would have looked the person in the eye, or if you would have thought about how the person was just lying in the bed or on the sofa, then you should have at least thought that this is something wrong in this situation. And you could have asked, are you really drunk or something?
I guess the big question is, what constitutes giving consent?
Well, the consent can be given both verbally and physically.
How would you go about proving? I mean, verbal consent, I can see it. I mean, even then, like, what would be physical consent?
Well, if someone is answering with the same kind of action as the one taking initiative to sex.
You're talking about a look in somebody's eyes that they're kind of interested in sex?
Yeah, that could be.
How would you
prove
that in court,
though? We would still have the same problems we have already today. With this new law, the burden of proof in court has not been changed. It's still the prosecutor having to prove there was an intent. So there still has to be exhaustive police investigations. The law should, however, give the police, the prosecutors and the court more instruments to ask the defendant other types of questions like, what made you think that the victim participated in free will? When the victim said or did this or that, how did you interpret that?
Would someone charged with breaking this new law, would they automatically be charged with rape?
No, it depends on what kind of sexual act they were committing or what sexual act is in focus, because rape is for some actions and then we have sexual assault for other actions.
And is the law applying to both men and women?
The new law is gender neutral, which it is already today, so that is not new. But everyone has to seek consent, or more specifically seek that the participation is based on free will. I mean, it's important to say that both men and women can be subjected to sexual crimes, but these types of assaults and this type of crime is not gender blinded. In Sweden, as well as in the rest of the world, I mean, the vast majority of sexual crimes have a male perpetrator, regardless of the gender of the victim. So, I mean, it is gendered.
So is Sweden entering an age where both partners about to have sex need to give some form of provable consent?
I mean, we are not going to have signed papers, but hopefully this will have normative effects in the society and especially in the area of norms around sexuality and sexual rights. The law will have a national information campaign, and that one must focus on sexual normativity and masculinities. Conversations about mutuality, communication in sexual situations, and boundaries. We must go beyond the slogan, a no is a no, and turn it into everything before a yes is a no, and start to talk about the actual situations that arises in sexual encounters, and give people concrete tools to communicate both verbal and nonverbal signs from other persons, as well as how to express their own wishes.
Do you think it's going to be hard to enforce the law because of that?
How the new Sexual Criminal Act will be implemented in the Swedish judicial system remains to be seen. I can see that judges will need education on victim psychology and how to use the new law to ask the right questions. The police investigators need to be able to prioritize these kind of cases to make exhaustive investigations. We should reintroduce the system of experts on sexual assaults within the police unit. So there are many things that we have got to do to shape this crime area up.
Sarah Backstrom, the senior legal advisor for the Swedish Association for Sexuality Education in Stockholm. Thanks very much, Sarah, for your time today.
Thank you very much.
Let's take a look ahead briefly to the show on Monday. The hassle of getting your car repaired is something people everywhere in the world have in common. We've got a story on the show from reporter Ari Plokta, who catches up with an Israeli settler whose van is on the blink.
I'm sitting with David near his home in his Citroën Berlingo, a gray French-made van. And there seems to be an issue with his ignition.
David is an Orthodox Jew. His favorite mechanic is a Palestinian, whose garage is just one Israeli roadblock away.
No one really knows the name of the place. I just know where it is. It's up the hill and around the corner.
And while it makes Israeli authorities nervous, lots of settlement Jews take their repairs to this Palestinian mechanic.
A lot of people come here, not just Jews. But most of the people that come here are Jewish because it's close to the border here and half the price.
Bad ignitions, brake pads, and exhaust systems somehow work to bring Israeli settlers and Palestinians together. It is a great story. We'll have it for you Monday. You're with the world. I'm Marco Werman, and you're with the world. Saudi Arabia is trying so hard to show the world how serious it is about doing better on human rights. Maybe the best example is the kingdom's decision to allow women to drive. But the recent arrests of activists in the country have raised concerns. It all started last weekend and has been going on since. Our own Shirin Jafari has been following the story. Shirin, how many people are we talking about in these arrests?
We are talking about at least 11 people. Most of them are women. We know that at least there are two men among them. One of them is an activist and the other is a lawyer. The latest update is that another activist has been arrested and three of the women have been released.
Okay, why these particular people? Why this group? And why is the Saudi leadership not happy with him?
Well, what's common among them is that they've all been involved in some form of activism in the past. Most of them have been pushing for the lifting of the driving ban, for example. They've also worked on putting an end to the guardianship laws.
Now, the guardianship laws, these are quite interesting and honestly quite oppressive, requires a male relative to make an important decision on behalf of women, for example, to travel or get a passport.
Yeah, and I want to tell you a story, Marco, that really shows what these activists have been working for and fighting against. This morning, I spoke with a woman. Her name is Moody Al-Jawani, and she's a women's rights activist from Saudi Arabia. She told me that 4 years ago, she came to study in the U.S. She was on a scholarship from the Saudi government. The Saudi government hands out scholarships like that very often. Then when she was on a break from school, she went back to Saudi to visit her family. And then her own family stopped her from leaving the country and coming back to the U.S.
They were not happy of how Americanized I become when I went to the United States. This is why they just canceled my scholarship. And then I was held against my will.
She says she couldn't leave for about 8 months. And she finally managed to trick her father to give back her passport. And she managed to make it back to the U.S. And when she got here, she had to start all over again. She said she didn't have any money. She wasn't able to finish her studies because her scholarship was canceled. Mm. And now she works for a HR department at a marketing company. And Marco, the activists who have been arrested recently in Saudi are trying to change rules like the ones that stopped women like Al-Jawani from leaving the country without the permission of a male family member.
And what is the official line about why these activists have been arrested?
Okay, so soon after the activists were taken in, pro-government outlets in Saudi started publishing their images on the front pages of their newspapers and on social media. And then they stamped these photos with a large red circle and the word traitor underneath, basically implying that these activists have been plotting against their own country and conspiring with foreign agents. And these are, in fact, the charges against these activists. Suspicious contact with foreign entities and plotting to undermine state security and stability.
Those sound kind of like vague charges. How serious are they?
They are vague, but they carry very serious sentences, sometimes up to 20 years in prison. That really worries activists' families and other human rights activists.
So what do these arrests and all these new moves mean for the image of Saudi? Because it wasn't so long ago that we saw the Crown Prince come to the United States and do this publicity tour, walking around the Google campus. He met these big shots in Silicon Valley and Washington. What are we to make of Saudi after these arrests?
Yeah, I put this question to Sarah Lee Whitson. She's the executive director of Human Rights Watch's Middle East and North Africa division. And she said, look, we shouldn't confuse the Crown Prince's visits abroad to what he does back home. When he's abroad, he's trying to sell an image. His message is, my country is modernizing, it's open for business, come invest in it. Mm. And he did roll out some reforms inside the kingdom. The driving ban, for example, is going to be lifted in a couple of weeks. There are movie theaters opening up. There was a fashion show. You know, women are allowed in stadiums. These are things that activists have been working on for decades. It was just mind-blowing to see all these changes happen so fast in Saudi. But Sarah Lee Whitson says that these recent arrests sent a really clear message.
By arresting these women and men, by punishing them so publicly, by accusing them of the worst offenses, it's really a massive warning sign to anyone else in the country who dares open their mouths. So are movie theaters going to open in the country? Yes. Are Saudis going to be allowed to discuss and debate the movies? No.
Wow. So what now, Sharon? I mean, what's being done to release these activists?
Human rights groups say they're following these cases very closely. The families of the activists are also trying to do what they can to get them out. I reached out to the Saudi embassy in Washington, D.C. and asked about these activists' arrests, but they never got back to me.
The World's Sharon Jafari, thanks so much for telling us about this.
No problem, Marco.
Just enough time before the break to tell you about yellow crazy ants. Yeah, a good band name, but this is not a music story. This is about actual yellow crazy ants. Millions of them have overrun the Australian town of Lismore. The BBC's been speaking with my colleague Phil Mercer, who, lucky for him, is following the story from 600 miles away in Sydney.
It's thought that these ants were brought accidentally to Australia back in the 1950s from Africa. They've decimated populations of ground-dwelling birds, insects and lizards in Queensland. Australia has a territory in the Indian Ocean called Christmas Island, and these yellow crazy ants are believed to have killed tens of millions of red land crabs there in the 1990s. And as far as the infestation in the town of Lismore is concerned, the experts aren't sure how they got there.
So what kind of devastation are they leaving in Lismore? Is it crops as well as smaller animals as well?
Well, the danger is that these crazy ants, and by the way, they're named because of their erratic style of walking and frantic movements. It's feared that they could create so-called super colonies. We do know that they spread very quickly. They can damage crops, beehives, as well as other native flora and fauna. And experts are pretty worried because the only infestation in New South Wales that we know of was in 2008, and the scale of that was around 150 metres by 100 metres. But this infestation in Lismore is thought to cover the entire town centre.
When you think about an ant being able to kill a bird, it's a bit of a David and Goliath battle. So how do they manage to do that?
Well, they don't sting, but they do spray something called formic acid to subdue their prey and also as a defensive mechanism, and it can irritate the skin and eyes in large amounts. And people in Queensland have reported being temporarily blinded by this acid. In terms of control, the authorities say that baiting or spraying is the way to go. But at the moment, experts in Lismore are trying to get a grip on as to how many ants there are there and how to deal with them.
That was the BBC's Phil Mercer in Sydney. You're at The World. I'm Marco Werman. A New York Times reporter faces criticism for removing thousands of ISIS documents from Iraq. But if she hadn't, she says, they would have been destroyed.
So we actually saved them for the purpose of being able to report on this group.
We hear from the reporter, one of her critics, and a legal expert. That's just ahead here on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH here in Boston. In April, the New York Times published the ISIS files by Rukmini Kalamaki. She's a Times correspondent and frequent guest on our show. Kalamaki's investigation examined the inner workings of the Islamic State. It drew on some 15,000 pages of internal ISIS documents that she'd discovered and removed during five trips to Iraq. The documents are also cited in the New York Times Caliphate podcast. But the project has raised both ethical and legal concerns. Should reporters be permitted to remove documents from war zones? Do news organizations have the right to hold this sort of material privately? Should the names of individuals cited in the documents have been redacted? Rukmini Kalamaki joined us to try to answer some of those questions.
Everywhere that I went when I was in Iraq, I was embedded with Iraqi troops, Iraqi security forces. And the reason that I was embedded with them is that the areas where these buildings were located were almost always either on the front lines or in areas that had just recently been liberated. And so they were not considered safe for civilians like myself to go into. So before we went into any of these areas, we sat down with the commander of the unit in question, and the New York Times, which at that point was myself, my translator, my security advisor, we would sit down with the commander and explain our objectives, which was to report on the ongoing situation, but also to look for documents. So it was the Iraqi security forces themselves who led us to these buildings. I was always walking directly behind them. I was not in front of them. And they're the ones who helped us find these records and helped us collect them. And in certain instances, they were literally holding the trash bag for me to help me collect the papers. The reason they did this is because they themselves had already gone through these areas and they had taken what they felt was of intelligence value. And their plan for the records was actually to burn them. Time and again, we would get to a building and we would be told, "We're so sorry, we just burned everything."
So, Rukmini, set the scene for us in 2017 when you're presented with this opportunity to see some ISIS files in Western Mosul. It's still fraught in the city. ISIS has booby-trapped buildings. What's going on? Where do you go?
Western Mosul was the place where ISIS made its last stand. And the area was heavily mined. You might recall that there was a group of French journalists who were actually killed in Western Mosul not too long before I got there. So we got permission to go to Western Mosul. We were once again with the Iraqi security forces there. They took us to a building that we believed was the seat of ISIS's Ministry of War Spoils. They had such a thing, the Ministry of War Spoils. Just as we got there, the security forces came out and there had been a miscommunication and they wanted to let us know that the documents inside had already been burned.
So let's hear an excerpt from Caliphate that was recorded at that time. The voices we're going to hear are you and your translator speaking with Iraqi troops during the battle to retake Mosul.
He says you're the first guy, the first people to ask about documents. So every time we find some documents, we just burn it.
Oh my God, no. Are you serious? You burn it? You can learn so much more about this terrorist group by looking at these documents.
So what happened next?
So they told us that everything inside had been burned. We asked for permission to go inside anyway and see if there was anything else of value. We were ducking underneath the wires and the pieces of the ceiling that had fallen down. Mm. And inside, it was just charred ruins. We walked through and I was able to collect not a lot of documents, but I would say probably half a bag's worth of stuff that managed to make it through the fire.
Just to be clear, yeah. Was anyone, as you walked through these warrens of rooms, was there yeah. anybody from the Iraqi government with you at the time? Or did anybody yes. protest as you started putting these documents into these trash bags?
They were supervising me as I picked up these things. So this is where I think this debate is missing some perspective. It's not a case of me taking these documents, the New York Times taking them back to America, or them existing in some institution in Iraq. It's the New York Times saving these documents or these documents not existing at all because they were being destroyed.
There have, as you know, been two academic protests about your removal of these documents from Iraq. One is led by doctoral student Sarah Farhan, who published a petition in April, and she argues that your article, The ISIS Files, shared personal and biographic information of Iraqi civilians without their consent. Does Farhan have a point?
Farhan, of course, lives in the United Kingdom, so it's perhaps a little bit different than here. But you and I, Marco, both know that all it takes is a LexisNexis search for everything down to our social security number and our home addresses to come up. So I think that we need to put these things in perspective. Personal information of that nature is out in the world. Now, of course, we would redact information if we believed that there was any real risk to causing harm to an Iraqi civilian. That is why we have redacted the names of, for example, Yazidi rape survivors when they appear in documents. But to say that a document, like a birth certificate, that somehow causes harm to the person, I just don't see it.
There's also the argument presented by Judith Tucker and Laurie Brand of the Middle East Studies Association. They sent an open letter to top editors at the Times, arguing that removing documents from Iraq with no clear plans to return them, quote, once again empowers outsiders to unduly influence or even control the narration of Iraq's history, end quote. And they accuse the Times of having no right to possess or retain these materials. So what would you like to say to Tucker and Brand?
The thing that they're missing is, as we explained in our piece, the goal of the Times is to make these documents available to all. The framework here is not the New York Times taking these things and versus them existing at Baghdad University. It's the New York Times taking them or them not existing at all. But before my article was published, the newsroom had begun an initiative to find an outside partner. We're specifically looking at academic institutions, universities. We don't want to work with any group that has a partisan flavor to it, of course, to digitize the trove, to translate it, and to make it available so that everybody can see it, to put them online so that everyone has access to them, human rights groups, the Iraqi government, etc.
Rukmini, final question. 15,000 pages of documents. That's a lot of paper. Physically, how do you get that out of Iraq?
I took it in my suitcase, and it was declared at the airport when I left. My bags were searched, phone calls were made, and the officials at the airport deemed that I had the right to take them.
Rukmini Kalamaki there at the New York Times. Now, I mentioned that open letter to the New York Times by academics Judith Tucker and Laurie Brand. They argue that Kalamaki's removal of the documents is illegal and unethical. Laurie Brand, professor of Middle East Studies at the University of Southern California, joins me. So, Professor Brand, I don't know if you read the ISIS files or listened to the podcast Caliphate, but just what was your reaction when you learned about how Ms. Kalamaki conducted some of her on-the-ground reporting and research?
Well, actually, I did read the ISIS files when it first appeared in print. So I saw it in the Sunday edition of the Times. I believe that was April 8th. And I was immediately struck by the fact that Ms. Kalamaki had, as she said, recovered. I don't know how you can recover material that didn't belong to you in the first place, but that's another issue. That she had recovered these files during five different trips, I believe it was. And it just had echoes for me of what had happened following the U.S. invasion of Iraq in 2003, when the U.S. military removed millions of documents. Most of those documents now are at Stanford University, but it means that the access to them is quite limited for Iraqis. But it also raises all sorts of issues about who has the right to these documents, the circumstances of the removal. So these issues came up to me as I was reading Ms. Kalamaki's piece, and I was very disturbed as I read some of the material or the descriptions that she gave of how she came upon these things and then came to use them.
Rukmini Kalamaki's main argument is that these documents would have been burned if she hadn't taken them. She did, I mean, rescue them. Should she have let them be burned?
No, of course not. And nobody's making that, no one's making that case. I mean, I think she's deliberately sort of avoiding the key issue here. You know, we understand that these documents otherwise would have been burned. So in that respect, the fact that she saved them is to be commended. It's what happens to them afterwards that's the problem. There are other people who have removed documents from former ISIS sites, and they've kept them in country. I mean, Jinan Musa is one person who's done work on the Yazidis, and she found a way to keep the documents in the country. I think that's where the difference is between the way that Ms. Kalamaki is viewing this and the way that we view this.
So another objection that I know you've brought up and other critics have brought up is that the New York Times did not redact personal information in some of these documents. Rukmini Kalamaki says that this kind of information is widely available anyway. How do you respond to that?
I'm perplexed by that sort of an argument. This isn't about whether we can go online somewhere and find out the birth date of an Iraqi. This is about the information being on particular kinds of documents in a particular situation. Ms. Kalamaki was trying to stress the importance of context and explaining what she did. I think that, you know, she needs to think about the importance of context with regard to this kind of personal information. I think it's very cavalier, in fact, to suggest that just because you can find an Iraqi's name and his or her birth date somewhere online, that therefore whatever may be on these documents with regard to personal information is also therefore sort of basically public information. I think that's a question to be determined. That's not something that one can just take for granted up front. So no, I find that extremely problematic. And that certainly has been something that has been raised by a lot of people, Iraqis, I think, in the forefront of them.
Something you said earlier suggests that you see this tapping into a long, long history of Westerners going in and, quote unquote, rescuing objects. Talk a bit about that, because I think of the Elgin marbles from Greece still in the British Museum, the obelisk of Aksum from Ethiopia, which was repatriated. Do you see this in kind of the same light?
Yes, and I think it's important that Iraqis see it in the same light. So for Iraqis, yes, this seems like just the most recent episode. And you know what happened to Iraq in 2003 and the tremendous destruction that was visited on the country, I mean, certainly its people, but also its institutions, is something which is also very current for Iraqis. I mean, when an outsider comes, and I realize Ms. Kalamaki has no responsibility for the U.S. invasion in 2003, but one thinks about the tremendous destruction that the U.S. caused to institutions, that the one place that the U.S. Sent troops to guard the files, if you will, was the oil ministry, while the Iraqi National Museum and other buildings and institutions were being plundered, looted, or destroyed as a result of bombing. That's really a very difficult legacy for people to deal with when they see, or I mean, it shapes the way that they understand these more recent episodes of removing documents. And I would also just say, with particular regard to the New York Times, when one talks about the invasion of 2003, the involvement of Judith Miller and the stories that she wrote in the period, you know, leading up to the war, which in effect helped to justify or lay the groundwork for the acceptance of the need for an invasion. And as a result of which she ultimately was, you know, had to be separated from the Times. That also, I think, gives the New York Times a special responsibility, I think, in this particular case, to be thinking about the role that one of its reporters played in the 2003 invasion and the kind of responsibility that perhaps it has toward the Iraqi people going forward.
Laurie Brand, a professor of Middle East Studies at the University of Southern California. She's also chair of the Committee on Academic Freedom at the Middle East Studies Association. Clearly, there are many ways to look at the removal of these ISIS documents from Iraq. So we wanted to get one more perspective on this, a legal one. Patty Gerstenblith directs the Center for Art, Museum, and Cultural Heritage Law at DePaul University in Chicago. And I asked her if international laws enshrined in various Hague conventions and UN resolutions were applicable in this case.
Unfortunately, I would say it's not clear. Most of those sources of international law that you just cited refer to the conduct of state parties, in other words, countries that have ratified those particular legal instruments. In this case, of course, the removal was done by an individual, not by a country. So it points up some of the shortcomings of international law. And it's not clear to me that these provisions would apply to this circumstance.
How would the ISIS documents at the center of this case be classified under international law?
Archives certainly can be cultural property and are defined as cultural property under both the Hague Convention and the 1970 UNESCO Convention, which are the two core international legal instruments that we operate under today. But whether their removal was illegal would be defined by Iraqi law. The problem is it's not clear that Iraqi law was violated.
And do you think it makes a difference that Rukmini Kalamaki had the permission of Iraqi officials on site in Mosul at the time when she found these documents?
I would have preferred that she had some official or more official consent to remove them, particularly consent in writing. So if this was some informal statement of, sure, go ahead and take them, I don't know that that can bind the Iraqi government itself.
So the New York Times has said it's going to digitize these documents and publish them online. As far as you're aware, would that sort of publication and circulation violate any international law?
I do not believe so, but besides the technicalities of the law, there are what we can consider moral and ethical considerations. I think the intellectual property of these archives should belong to the Iraqi people. It should be for them to decide what gets published and what benefit will be derived. And this applies whether we're talking about translation and publication of ancient cuneiform tablets that have been looted from Iraq or modern documents. These countries have been denuded of their intellectual past, and it prevents the development of their modern scholars and scholarship. So I can't point to a law that prohibits the New York Times from doing this, but I do believe that as a more moral or ethical stance, this should be done in cooperation with the Iraqi government.
It's not a simple debate, is it, this case?
Definitely not.
Patty Gerstenblith with DePaul University. Thank you very much.
By all means.
Colombia is holding a presidential election this weekend, the first one since the peace deal with the rebel FARC movement was signed. But another country is actually on the minds of many Colombians, and that would be Venezuela. I have Veronica Zaragovia on the line with us from Bogota. So why, with this presidential election weekend coming up, Veronica, are people in Colombia thinking about Venezuela?
Well, hi, Marco. The reason for that is that the economic freefall of the neighboring country is a real stark reality here. There are so many Venezuelans who have migrated here into Colombia, and Colombians have told me they're frustrated that because they're willing to take a lower pay, because their situation is so dire, that they're displacing low-income Colombians from their jobs.
It really does sound like this election is being almost entirely driven by the specter of Venezuela. Do you want Colombia to be like Venezuela or not? I mean, it suggests what a huge impact the economic collapse in Venezuela seems to have had on its neighbor.
Yes, absolutely. The thing is that Colombia's economy also, this was an oil exporting economy that has been pinched ever since crude oil prices have been dropping in the last, 5 years or so. And so it's not like Colombia is doing so well either. And so the right has really framed it that if a left-wing candidate were to rise into power, it could really usher in a very bad time for this country. And so it really is an election that's focused on the economy.
So tell us about the two front runners.
Sure. So the two front runners are Gustavo Petro, who's on the far left, and he was a former militant with the M19 guerrilla group. And so he is pledging free healthcare, free education. He also wants to tax the wealthy. So I spoke with some of his supporters in a low-income part of Bogota called Kennedy. And one of his supporters, Odilia Riaño, she is a food vendor on the streets. And she said that Gustavo Petro on the left is looking out for the poor.
Sí, yo voy a votar por Petro. Porque me gustan mucho las ideas de él, favorece mucho a la clase, pues, pobre, a la clase.
Marco, what she said is that Petro has spoken about supporting people like her. He understands that street vendors need to be able to sell on the streets without being moved off, that they need to work to support their families. And she says past presidents haven't done anything to lift people like her out of poverty, and she wants change. She wants someone new.
So the other candidate is Ivan Duque. He's on the far right. Tell us why his supporters like him.
He's a businessman in his early 40s. And the people who would favor him are mostly people who fear that either, and not necessarily just rich people, but people who are seeing how bad it's gotten in Venezuela, how many Venezuelans have moved here to Colombia, and they don't want that to happen here. But then, of course, it's also people who have suffered kidnappings during the years that the FARC were in power. And so I found a Iván Duque supporter in a very wealthy part of Bogotá, and his name is Jorge Guevara, and he's an executive in a construction company. And I want to play this tape for you.
He sufrido el síndrome del secuestro, el asalto, la extorsión.
He's experienced a kidnapping, assault, and extortion in his family. And so he was telling me, I'm sitting today speaking to you in this beautiful, marvelous park, feeling calm, but I cannot tell you that I would feel this sense of calm after Sunday's election. And he did, after that, tell me that he has booked tickets to leave Colombia should Gustavo Petro eventually win the presidency.
That Duque supporter we just heard did mention the peace deal with the leftist FARC rebels, approved in 2016. And the current president, Juan Manuel Santos, won a Nobel Peace Prize for it. So how is the peace deal playing into these elections?
The thing is that originally the peace deal was proposed to the people in a referendum, and the majority voted against it. And then current President Santos, he got the Congress to approve it rather than after making some changes, bringing it back to the people. And so what I hear from all sectors of society, poor and rich and left and right, is that a lot of them are upset that this is not the peace that they are, of course, that peace is vital to Colombia and to Colombia's future, but they did not agree to having a lenient sentence for the FARC members, and they did not want FARC members to be able to serve in the Congress, as they will be able to do when the new Congress comes in on July 20th. And so if Iván Duque on the right wins the presidency and he blocks implementation of some parts of this peace treaty, they're not particularly, a lot of people are not very worried about that because they say this isn't the peace treaty they wanted.
Veronica, I know you've got family in Colombia. What kind of conversations have you been having with them about this election?
Our conversations are about the kind of, to be honest with you, Gustavo Petro is part of the M19 group that kidnapped a member of my family, and that's why we left Colombia in 1983. And mm-hmm. So people in my immediate family who are voting in this election have said there's no way they would be able to vote for Gustavo Petro.
I mean, given how widespread the violence was with the FARC in Colombia, do you find a lot of people making these political vote decisions based on some personal experiences?
Yes, I think a lot of people are thinking about what they went through, and the peace treaty, essentially what it did is end a conflict that lasted for 52 years that's so fresh on people's minds. And so a lot of people are voting based on personal stories. So that really does come into play in how voters will cast their ballots.
Veronica Zaragovia, a reporter in Bogota, thanks very much for your time today.
Thanks very much for yours.
Okay, let's wrap things up today with some music from Colombia. This is a number for everyone listening today, you grown-ups and you kids, perhaps in the back seat off on your long holiday weekend. It's a traditional tune sung by the husband and wife duo Uno, Dos, Tres, Andrés. Andrés Salguero grew up in Colombia. His wife, Christian Sanabria, grew up in Kansas City in a Spanish-speaking household. Together as Uno, Dos, Tres, Andrés, they travel around the U.S. promoting literacy and bilingual education. We'll close with their rendition of Un Elefante, because what's not to love about elephants or songs about elephants? Un Elefante is from their new children's album, La Luna. From the Nana Bill Harris Studios at WGBH here in Boston, I'm Marco Werman. The world's theme music was composed by Eric Goldberg. We're back with you on Monday. In the meantime, here's wishing you a relaxing Memorial Day weekend. Balanceaba sobre la tela de una araña, como veía que resistía, fue a llamar a otro elefante. Elefante, dos elefantes se balanceaban sobre la tela de una araña. PRI, Public Radio International.